Certainly no, we don't. We do not have that information. And informant is a term of art, right? He was helping police in many ways, but for the FBI likes to sort of have a specific sort of uses that term for a specific relationship they have with sources or informers. It's unclear, but he was clearly doing many things. As we said, he was just providing information, and back then he was providing information. He was going undercover for local police departments. But after that, we don't know what happened. We did say in the story, he told us that he had told police departments of upcoming rallies to be helpful. That is, it
We have
wasn't sort
5 seconds.
of. Well, it was he. We discussed that a little bit in the story, where he said he had discussed certain things with law enforcement
Aram
recently.
Rostam, we want to thank you for being with us. Investigative journalist with Reuters. We're linked to your new piece. Proud Boys leader was prolific informer for law enforcement. That does it for our show. Tune in tomorrow when we look at the new film, My Name Is Pauli Murray. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Remember, wearing a mask, even two, is an act of love.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing, unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The Finance Committee will meet on Thursday, February 4th at 4:30. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
Hi everyone, I'm Henry, and I'd like to invite you to listen to Fortress on a Hill on KBOO Portland. My co-hosts and I are three leftist veterans that aim to expose the reality of the U.S. military's multiple wars abroad and illuminate the damage military service does to Americans and foreign citizens around the world. How can we stand by and do nothing while our military kills and destroys the lives the world over, while telling Americans that all this death and destruction protects them from terrorists, when nothing could be more false? Fortress on a Hill aims to change that. You can listen to us at 9 a.m. on the second and fourth Thursdays of the month right here on KBOO. And thanks.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, thousands more doses of COVID-19 vaccine are heading to Multnomah, Clackamas, and Washington counties. Who's eligible to get them next? Oregon health workers protest conditions they say are not keeping them safe from the COVID-19 virus. And why standardized testing for Portland public school students is going to look a lot different. It's another way the pandemic is affecting us. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, January 28, 2021. I'm Annette Newell. Oregon hospital workers lead a protest over COVID-19 safety measures. The members of SEIU Local 49 have been negotiating a contract with Providence Milwaukee Hospital for more than 2 years. Eric Tegedoff has more in the story.
Frontline hospital workers in Milwaukee, Oregon are calling for better COVID-19 safety precautions. Workers representing about 170 Service Employees International Union Local 49 members picketed on Wednesday outside the Providence Milwaukee Hospital to bring attention to the issue. Heather Decoto, a patient dining specialist at the hospital, believes Providence could reduce the spread of COVID-19 by giving employees paid administrative leave so they can be quarantined and tested.
I feel that Providence is lacking in this. I believe that they need to step it up as a responsibility to their community and to their patients.
Decoto says she worries about bringing the virus home to her mother, with whom her family lives. A spokesperson for Providence says the hospital follows the latest health guidelines from the CDC and Oregon Health Authority on the virus. Decoto says workers have been negotiating with Providence management for more than 2 years on a contract. She also wants more affordable health care, saying she has put off knee surgery because of the expense.
I'm working every day in pain that distracts me at times. I have to work that much harder to stay focused and to give my best at my job.
Providence notes they've held 29 bargaining sessions. Both sides have agreed to a federal mediator and will have their first mediated session on February 9th. In the meantime, Decoto says she and her SEIU Local 49 colleagues help the hospital run.
I consider the support workers the foundation. We support every department in this hospital. And when we are supported and we support the hospital, we can give our patients optimum care.
SEIU Local 49 represents about 15,000 health care and building service workers in Oregon and Southwest Washington, including nursing assistants, emergency department technicians, and housekeepers. For Public News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
The Oregon Health Authority counts 750 new COVID-19 cases today and 6 new deaths. This puts the state's death toll at 1,930. More than 140,000 people statewide have been infected. But tens of thousands of people in Oregon's most populated counties should soon be able to get a shot in the arm to protect against the COVID-19 pandemic. KBOO's Jeffrey Wade has the latest on the story.
Oregon Governor Kate Brown announced on Twitter Wednesday evening that the state will be sending additional COVID-19 vaccine doses to the Tri-County region next week. According to Brown's tweet, at least 17,000 doses have been additionally allocated to Multnomah, Washington, and Clackamas counties in hopes of expediting the vaccination of the high-priority Phase 1A eligible group. The extra doses are in addition to the 15,000 doses already allotted to be sent to the Tri-County region next week, and is also aimed at educators hoping to receive their first dose as public schools poise for a gradual reopening. Public health officials told the state earlier in the week that while several counties have already completed their first dose of vaccinations of people in Phase 1A, there were simply not enough available doses to inoculate the tens of thousands of Phase 1A eligible people in the metro counties. Brown said the combined 32,000 doses for the metro counties will make up about 60% of the 53,000 first dose vaccinations being sent across the state. Those eligible for vaccination under Phase 1A include healthcare providers at hospitals and urgent care facilities, nursing and memory care facility staff and residents, tribal health programs, emergency medical relief providers, and first responders. Other eligible people include healthcare providers and residents at long-term care facilities and congregate care sites such as hospice programs, mobile care, and related services, individuals working in a correctional setting, and personnel of group homes for children or adults with intellectual and developmental disabilities. In addition to people in Phase 1A, teachers are also now eligible, controversially preempting seniors aged 80 and older, who will become eligible the week of February 7th. Brown stands behind her decision to prioritize teachers and school staff over Oregon seniors, maintaining it is the only way schools can safely begin reopening procedures and get students back in class for their own mental health. In the weeks following February 7th, seniors in younger age groups and other essential workers will be next in line for the vaccinations. For the KBOO Evening News, I'm Jeffrey Wade.
Portland Public Schools are making plans to start standardized testing at home after canceling assessments last fall. Oregon's largest school district is getting its staff ready to begin the at-home tests as early as next week, despite concerns from teachers and families of students who are already coping with the challenges of remote learning. The push from PPS to measure achievements over the last year comes at the same time administrators are gearing up to offer limited in-person instruction at schools across Portland. However, staff from at least 12 Portland schools, as well as numerous letters from local parent-teacher associations in support of educators, are asking PPS officials to suspend the tests at this time. They're citing worries that testing now may cause more harm than good. Critics of the standardized tests say testing kids now is not worth the time and stress it will put on the students, with many struggling to make academic progress over the past year. Educators also say that the home tests will not provide reliable data, will disrupt already compromised class time, and further racial inequities. Alicia Chavez, a K through second grade special education teacher at Southeast Portland's Atkinson Elementary, says, "Yes, I do want data. I do want to see where the kids are. But at the same time, we're in the middle of a pandemic. Giving them an assessment right now isn't going to help." PPS officials' response to the pushback is to say the data will only be for planning purposes, not evaluation purposes. The measure of academic progress, or MAP tests, track academic progress over time versus the exams that are typically used each year to identify academic accountability. 24 public school districts in Oregon, 52 private schools in the state, and thousands more nationwide use the MAP tests. Still, teachers and parents warn that testing students now could result in lagging motivation and even more disengagement. Julie Bolstead, a parent and PTA president at Southeast Portland's Grout Elementary, questions the use of MAP testing when it comes to racial equity. She says, quote, "I do not envy the challenge the district faces to utilize its expenditure of the MAP tests, but how can it tout the call to work for racial equity one day and require teachers to use it without supports in place for underserved communities the next?" Bolstead and others feel that students need their teachers and instructional routines in place before testing, and that their mental health should be the top priority. In 29 states, LGBTQ people can still be evicted, denied health care, or turned away from businesses because of their sexual orientation. But now, as Andrea Sears reports, human rights advocates see new hope for legislation called the Equality Act.
A new report says a bill that's often promoted as expanding rights for LGBTQ people could benefit a wide spectrum of racial and religious minorities as well. The Equality Act passed in the U.S. House in 2019 with broad bipartisan support, but never came up for a vote in the Senate. Civil rights advocates are hopeful this year it could become law. The bill would add new comprehensive federal protections for lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender people. Naomi Goldberg with the Movement Advancement Project says it would expand existing federal laws that leave many people vulnerable to discrimination based on a variety of other factors.
Right now, for example, retail stores are actually not covered under federal law and public accommodations protections for people of color or people of faith or immigrants.
Opponents of the bill say it would infringe on the religious freedom of those who feel that homosexuality, same-sex marriage, or transgender identities violate their beliefs. But Goldberg points out that 21 states, including New York, already have LGBT rights laws on the books, so someone can lose civil rights protection simply by crossing a state line. The Equality Act would change that.
It would put into place consistent and explicit protections into federal law that would in many ways serve as an umbrella over all 50 states, D.C., and the territories.
She adds, under a U.S. Supreme Court ruling issued last June, federal law already protects against discrimination based on sexual orientation or gender identity in employment. But Goldberg emphasizes the bill would make anti-discrimination protections consistent across the board. She points to a 2020 survey by Sephora that found 40% of shoppers had experienced discrimination based on their race or skin color.
I think that really underscores the challenges of accessing places of public accommodations aren't just for LGBTQ people, but this is really a broad problem and needs a federal solution.
The bill has yet to be introduced in the House this year, but Goldberg is hopeful that with changes in Senate leadership, it would get a hearing and a vote there as well. For Public News Service, I'm Andrea Sears.
In Western states, many older residents face special challenges to find affordable housing built to meet their needs. Suzanne Potter tells us about an effort in California where senior advocates are pressing for more affordable housing.
California faces an enormous shortage of affordable housing, and a group that advocates for older residents is looking for solutions. This week, AARP California has published a new report on the need for housing. It's the result of months spent convening experts and stakeholders to tackle the issue of affordability. AARP California Associate State Director Rafi Nazarians says the state can shore up support for affordable housing by reinvigorating the social compact between generations.
It refers to an implicit agreement between generations to share resources and support one another across phases of life.
The report found there's a strong perception that older adults tend to oppose affordable housing projects in their areas when they come up for local approval. AARP wants to reframe the issue, hoping to increase support among its millions of members for projects that allow everyone in a community to thrive. Nazarians says the research shows red tape is another huge obstacle to getting new housing approved and built, because it can take years to comply with a thicket of environmental, land use, and zoning regulations.
The largest area of consensus was on the need for a much simplified process at all levels of government and at all junctures of development of affordable housing in California.
And the demand for affordable housing specifically designed for older adults is likely to increase. Statistics show by 2030, 1 in 3 Californians will be over age 50 and 17% will be over age 65. For Public News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
You're listening to the KABU Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth report on using the Defense Production Act for vaccine production. At 6, it's Rose City Native Radio. Then at 8, the Soul Connection. Tonight's weather, mostly cloudy skies, down to 37 overnight. Tomorrow's weather, cloudy, a high of 47. By late in the evening, we'll see some steady rain and a good chance of that rain hanging around through the weekend too, with highs near 50. Today in history, on this date in 1986, the Space Shuttle Challenger liftoff from Cape Canaveral, Florida, carrying Christa McAuliffe on her way to become the first ordinary American civilian, a teacher, to travel in space. 73 seconds after liftoff, the shuttle broke up in a forking plume of smoke and fire. Our quote of the day is from Christa McAuliffe, who said, "If I can get some student interested in science, if I can show members of the general public what's going on up there in the space program, then my job's been done." As the saying goes, elections have consequences. And this time around, the U.S. Senate now has a narrow Democratic majority, with Vice President Kamala Harris casting the tie-breaking vote. That also means big changes for an Oregon Democrat, who will soon lead one of the most powerful committees in the U.S. Senate.
We're talking to Oregon U.S. Senator Ron Wyden about becoming the chairman of the Senate Finance Committee. Welcome, Senator Wyden.
Thanks for having me.
You're taking this leadership position over from Iowa Republican Chuck Grassley. I know you've had a pretty good working relationship with him, but this is going to be quite a shift and change. What kinds of changes can we expect going forward?
Certainly, with respect to the key issues in front of the committee, we're talking about tax fairness, for example. I'm concerned that a nurse, say, in Gresham, who's treating COVID patients, pays taxes with every single paycheck. And yet billionaires who made enormous sums in the last year during the pandemic, to a great extent, can defer their taxes, and pretty much end up paying nothing. So I want an economic system where you grow from the middle out. I'm going to be focused on the needs of small businesses, making sure those folks who've been hit so hard in Oregon start getting a fair shake. And then we'll also be zeroing in on holding down the cost of medicine. Seems to me that we ought to take away subsidies, for example, for big pharmaceutical companies that rip people off with insulin prices and price gouge.
You've been serving as the ranking member of the minority. Now with the majority, you're going to be chairman. Tell me how that will be different.
What's different in that is you can play offense. You know, I went to school on a basketball scholarship, and you have to always play both ends of the court. But if you want to set the agenda in Washington, D.C., you've got to play offense. So, for example, I'm going to focus early on in repairing broken, dysfunctional system of unemployment in America and help Oregon as well. I wrote the law, I think you all are aware, that provided the extra $600 per week, and all the new people, the gig workers, the self-employed, and the independent contractors, we still got billions of dollars out across Oregon for folks who are trying to make rent and buy groceries. But we had all these problems with the Oregon Employment Division and people couldn't get through and the like. I'm going to really zero in on getting those fixed.
You have been chairman of the Finance Committee before, back in 2014. How have your priorities changed since then, and what's going to be different this time around?
I had just a short time as chairman before. We did focus on something that's been a huge success in manufacturing, and that is dealing with beer and wine and cider, which creates jobs in Oregon all the way from the fields, the hops and the grapes, for the trucking industry, for the manufacturing industry that produces the equipment that stores the product. I'm going to be focused now on helping us build back better. And that has been the theme of what the new president wants to do. Our committee basically has the opportunity to lead on that. Janet Yellen had her hearing to head the Department of Treasury. She's been confirmed again and again. I asked her, Chair Yellen, because she chaired the Federal Reserve, what will get you the most bang for the buck? And she mentioned essentially my unemployment kind of approach, because Annette, that money on a weekly basis is spent local. It's spent on groceries, it's spent paying the rent, it's spent at the pharmacy, it's spent at the store where you're buying shoes for your kids. It's a big economic multiplier.
And as far as those $1,400 payments, do you think that that's going to have a lot of strong support now?
I believe certainly we can get it passed. I know that Republicans are saying they have some reservations about the Biden package, but I'll tell you, there are so many people hurting right now. For example, when I got the $600 per week extra for the unemployed folks, the coronavirus rates were not as high as they are now. So we've got in Oregon thousands of people walking on an economic tightrope, balancing the food bill against the fuel bill against the rent bill. We got to help these people now. They're hurting now. And the kinds of programs that I'm talking about, helping small businesses, helping the unemployed as they try to deal with the fact they're out of work through no fault of their own, they're just trying to make rent and buy groceries. These are winners for the challenges we're facing, because that money, that assistance, is basically going to all be spent local.
About Janet Yellen, you think that there's nobody better qualified than her. Why are you so positive about her in this role?
You look at her tenure as chair of the Federal Reserve. She understood, for example, that you could create opportunity, that you could deal, for example, with the needs of the unemployed, and really strike a good balance between all of the forces that you needed to address. You had to be concerned about sparking inflation. You had to put people to work. She did such a good job, and basically through the end of the Obama administration, and then Donald Trump took credit for it, we had a strong economy, which really lasted all the way till the pandemic hit. And then Donald Trump just pretended that it could be played down repeatedly and you could just blame China and that'd be the end of it.
You're saying that the Biden administration is going to go all in with an all-out triage on the economy and the pandemic. What is that going to mean?
The first bills will involve the $2,000 checks, my expanded unemployment benefits, and then strong strategy to deal with the virus. I believe that you ought to use the Defense Production Act. You need a national plan where the federal government works with the states. You need to focus on the protective equipment, the PPE that the workers need, and you also need to deal with the workforce issues because we don't have enough workers.
What was inauguration day like for you?
Oh, it was so important to watch as Joe Biden basically signaled with every fiber of his being that he understands that our country is now deeply divided, and he's going to work to try to find common ground because it is so urgent we get help to the people that you and I are talking about.
What was your reaction when you found out about the results of the Senate elections in Georgia giving the majority to the Democrats? Were you surprised by that?
I was stunned that Donald Trump did so much to harm the Republican candidate there in Georgia, because he would always talk about things being rigged and then he would talk more about himself. And I was just amazed that the President of the United States, in the face of elections that would decide the majority in the United States Senate, would do so much to harm Republicans when all logical people were arguing that he should be trying to build them up.
What is it going to mean for us in Oregon that one of the state senators is chairing a major committee with a lot of power, really?
We do have the opportunity on the Finance Committee to tackle all the big issues that matter for our state. We have jurisdiction over also infrastructure, roads and bridges and transportation systems. I am going to be arguing, Annette, that every infrastructure bill should include broadband, because we've got a lot of places in our state that are just falling between the cracks, dead spots. You can't get a connection. I got $3 billion into the package at the end of the year to give families $50 a month assistance for connectivity for kids to connect to their schools and for parents who are working remotely. But there is so much more to do, whether it's small business, whether it's broadband, whether it's holding down prescription drug costs, which is refocusing the tax code on making sure that everybody has a chance to get ahead. And that's why I think it's a great, great honor to represent Oregon in the Senate and be on this key committee at a crucial time.
And Washington Senator Patty Murray is going to be chairing HELP, the Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee. So another Pacific Northwest senator is leading a very powerful committee. How is that going to impact the Pacific Northwest? And are you going to be working with her on some things?
I do. In healthcare, for example, the Finance Committee has jurisdiction over Medicare and Medicaid and the Children's Health Insurance Program, tax code that involves various incentives for employer-based coverage. Senator Murray handles the public health side, something like the Centers for Disease Control. So you bet we are very much a team tackling healthcare issues, and to have the team being led by the senators from the Pacific Northwest is an opportunity to really help our region.
What are your predictions about what's going to happen to taxes within the next 2 years?
My sense is that because every Democrat in the House and the Senate voted against the Trump bill because it was such a giveaway to special interests, I think we're going to pass significant tax reform. It's not going to be easy, but I think recognizing that Democrats saw what a giveaway the Trump proposal was, generated $1.5 trillion worth of debt, we're going to be able to pass a bill that focuses on getting a fairer system for the middle class, removing these tax breaks for shipping jobs overseas, and recognizing that special interests and multinational corporations have done a little over the last 4 years to make the investments in our communities that we need, and those are the kinds of efforts that we're going to reward.
And that was part of my recent interview with Oregon Democratic U.S. Senator Ron Wyden. Some Senate Democrats are considering alternatives to former President Trump's impeachment trial as Republicans dig in with opposition. And President Joe Biden signs executive orders to fight climate change and sets a modern record of these orders during his first week in office. Here's Laura Ross-Bartellum with today's edition of 2021 Talks.
With less likelihood enough Republican senators would vote to convict former President Donald Trump in an impeachment trial, Virginia's Democratic Senator Tim Kaine says he'd introduce a resolution censuring Trump if at least 10 Republicans join in. Some Senate Democrats are considering a shortened trial. President Joe Biden continued the fast pace of new executive orders yesterday.
I'm going to go over and sign that now.
Biden's close to 40 executive orders in his first week in office is a new record. Trump signed 5 in the same period. Some Republicans are quick to characterize Biden's pace as tyrannical, but political science experts know that many of Biden's executive orders reverse controversial Trump policies or simply reinstate some from the Obama administration that Trump had countermanded, 17 in Trump's first year. The president's new orders make fighting climate change a key piece of his administration's agenda.
It's about jobs, good-paying union jobs. It's about workers, building our economy back better than before. It's a whole-of-government approach. Put climate change at the center of our domestic, national security, and foreign policy.
Biden said he'll use the federal government's purchasing power and buy a large number of zero-emission vehicles, hoping to create 1 million new jobs in the American auto industry. The orders do have some impact, but Biden's $2 trillion climate plan, the primary engine for green job creation, is expected to face strong opposition in Congress. His other actions put a hold on new leases for oil and gas drilling in offshore waters and on public land, create a government-wide focus on reducing greenhouse gases, and a new commission focused on environmental justice. According to Rabbi Daniel Schwartz, who heads the Coalition on the Environment and Jewish Life, the moves reflect an understanding that the climate, economic growth, and environmental harms to communities of color are all connected.
There's a recognition that you have to be thinking about climate not just in one particular place, but across agencies. And there's a recognition of this crucial problem of environmental justice.
The Senate grilled Biden's nominee for U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Linda Thomas-Greenfield, about a speech she gave 2 years ago at Savannah State University's Confucius Institute. Dozens of these institutes across the country offer Chinese language classes and face criticism for allegedly being centers of Chinese propaganda.
The fact that this was associated with the Confucius Institute was truly a huge mistake on my part. It was done so that I could continue my commitment to engage with historical Black colleges.
Thomas Greenfield was clear America must counter the rise of China. Veteran diplomats praise her. She has 35 years of experience as a foreign service officer, most recently as top U.S. diplomat for African affairs. The Department of Homeland Security issued a rare national terrorism warning based on new information indicating the U.S. faces increased threats against elected officials in the wake of the Capitol riot on January 6th. Andrea Sears contributed reporting. For Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Laura Rosbrow-Tellum.
Private immigration prisons are not included in President Joe Biden's new ban. About 4 in 5 people in U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement custody were in privately run facilities as of January 2020. One example is in Washington State.
President Joe Biden signed an executive order this week ending the federal use of private prisons. But the order does not include privately run immigration facilities like the Northwest ICE Processing Center in Tacoma. Formerly known as the Northwest Detention Center, the facility is run by GEO Group and is one of the largest in the country. Maru Mora Villalpando is a community organizer with the group La Resistencia, which has long called for the center's shutdown. She sees Biden's order as misleading.
This is not the solution to the immigration detention enterprise that has been built. And now we have to push him and his entire administration to start phasing out private detention and ultimately close all detention centers.
The president's executive order is a continuation of an Obama-era policy. It directs the Justice Department not to renew its contracts with private prisons. More than 14,000 people are housed in these facilities. As of 1 year ago, 81% of people detained in ICE custody were held in privately owned facilities, according to the ACLU. Villalpando says Washington state lawmakers are considering House Bill 1090, which would ban private for-profit detention facilities.
We can't rely on Congress or on the president to solve all these problems. These problems are so complicated that we need to work at every level possible.
HB 1090 is scheduled for an executive session today in the House Committee on Public Safety. Villalpando says other states, including New Mexico and Maryland, also are working on banning private prisons. For Public News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
A state Senate Republican has filed a proposal this week that could limit some workers from getting a newly voter-approved $15 an hour minimum wage in Florida. Senate Judiciary Chairman Jeff Brandes from St. Petersburg filed the proposal that would allow the state to reduce the minimum wage for people convicted of felonies, state prisoners, workers younger than 21, and others he calls hard-to-hire employees. The resolution does not specify what the reduced wage would be or define that phrase, hard-to-hire. It is drawing fire from those who pushed to raise Florida's minimum wage last year. Voters approved the increase in November with an amendment raising Florida's minimum wage to $10 an hour starting September 30th and annual increases until it reached $15 an hour by September 30th, 2026. According to various workers' rights groups, including the Florida Pay Institute, Brandes' proposal could impact about 2.5 million workers across the state. Orlando lawyer John Morgan largely bankrolled the Citizen Initiative for wage increases. He criticized the proposed resolution, calling it a, quote, unconstitutional attempt to undermine the will of the voters, who resoundingly voted to ensure all of Florida's low-wage workers are paid enough to live and work with dignity. The Florida legislature will consider the proposal when it meets March 2nd. If it passes, it will appear on the 2022 ballot because it would amend the state's constitution and require 60% of voters to approve it. You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, January 28, 2021. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. You can call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Jeffrey Wade, Eric Tegedoff, Andrea Sears, and Suzanne Potter. The producer is Annette Newell, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Public News Service. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K2A2BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Annette Newell. We're so glad to have you with us for the KBOO Evening News. Now stay right here for KBOO News In Depth, coming up next.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
The United States' approach to tackling the coronavirus crisis is changing now that the Biden administration has taken office. They've announced a 100-day mask challenge and are in the process of pushing Congress to pass more stimulus relief. The challenge of the pandemic has also shifted to include vaccination to reach herd immunity. Concerns about supply, production, delivery, and administration are top of mind. One proposed solution to these problems is to use the Defense Production Act. This act allows the federal government to require cooperation from companies when it comes to producing things related to American security. It can put an order from the federal government at the top of the line, make manufacturing quicker, and at a reduced rate. I spoke with Ben Smilowitz, executive director of the Disaster Accountability Project, to learn more about the Defense Production Act and how it might be used to further the Biden administration's vaccination goals.
To get a little bit of background, what is the Disaster Accountability Project?
It's a nonprofit that I started about 13 years ago after Hurricane Katrina as a way of improving disaster relief and humanitarian aid, making sure that lessons are learned and that we do better.
So right now, your organization is advocating for President Biden to use the Defense Production Act to dramatically increase vaccine and PPE production to combat the COVID crisis. What has the Defense Production Act been used for in the past, and why is it a good tool for the coronavirus response?
Yeah, so it's a Korean War era law that has been used as many as 300,000 times in the last year alone, mostly by the federal government to put its contracts first in line, and it's mostly for military purchases. So it's been used on occasion for disasters. So this is a law that gives the federal government real sweeping powers when it comes to telling industry to produce more or prioritize its contracts first so that the federal government can come first in line on critical good purchases.
And so translating that to a coronavirus response, what would that look like?
Well, we've had shortages in PPE, personal protective equipment, testing equipment. We're underdeveloped when it comes to sequencing the virus. And a lot of these problems could have been solved over the last year by more aggressive use of Defense Production Act to get manufacturers and producers to make more of these items in the U.S., allowing the federal government and even states to buy these items on priority, so that instead of going through all these supply chains and even buy items internationally that sometimes lack in quality, we could be doing more here in the U.S. around production and fill gaps so that frontline workers are not still at risk. We haven't yet solved our PPE problems for frontline workers and medical workers, and it's been carnage, really, in among people that are helping. So we could have done a lot better. And now it looks like the Biden administration is committing to do better. And so we're asking them to use this law more aggressively for critical supplies like PPE, and a vaccine, and even let states make requests under Defense Production Act with guardrails, so that instead of states having to buy from out-of-state supply chains that have really jacked prices, and we're looking at states paying 5 to 10 times the dollar on certain items, states should be able to go right to in-state producers and buy from them directly with the help of the federal government. And this would save both states and the federal government a lot of money. It would help states' economies. It would get goods to the front lines much faster. These are all things that the federal government can do, especially if they're calling this a wartime effort.
Are there any drawbacks or concerns that, you know, you come up against about trying to get this act to be used more aggressively?
You're not really hearing much pushback. I think even Pfizer said that they welcome the federal government to use Defense Production Act to increase its purchase of vaccine doses. I don't actually know why our government hasn't been more aggressive in using this law. I think that the Trump administration didn't take this disaster seriously, so that may be one reason. But in terms of the Biden administration, I mean, they're just getting started, and I think that they've been making a number of good moves. I just want them to be even more aggressive.
What are the, like, where do we stand now? What are the moves that the Biden administration have taken so far? And do you think that they're trending in the direction of using the Defense Production Act?
It seems like that. I mean, so the last administration was a little standoffish when confronted with questions from media about whether they were using it. And I mean, the former president even would say things like, I'll use it when I want to use it, and not really tell us on what and for what and when items would be expected. It appears that this administration is willing to be more transparent about these things. And I think that part of it is even journalists asking more informed questions about, for exactly what did you order? When will we expect this item? And will you be doing this, this, and this? And then if they don't have the answer at the press conference, hopefully they can come back at the next press conference and bring the answer. So we've seen so far the federal government stepped up its purchase of vaccine now to 600 million doses by sometime the summer. And while that's a great step, we want a billion doses ordered of both the Pfizer and the Moderna vaccine. And the Defense Production Act can be used to do that, because the federal government can help Pfizer and Moderna increase productive capacity. That's what the law does. And we're talking about maybe even telling Merck and other pharmaceuticals to make the Pfizer or Moderna vaccine in their production houses, because they have capacity in their factories, and they're not doing COVID vaccines. They recently announced that. So why not have Merck do that? And I think the administration is considering that right now. But we need more vaccine, because first of all, children haven't been approved for the vaccine yet. And if and when they are, we should have those supplies on hand. And secondly, the whole world needs this vaccine. So just the U.S. having enough vaccine to help ourselves is not going to help us kick COVID. And some countries can buy it, and so we can make some of our money back. Others will need donations. But this net global pandemic is not going to be resolved until people all over the world are vaccinated. And so why not make those doses and those that vaccine here in the U.S.? It'll help our economy. It'll put more people to work. And we have the laws to do that. So we're saying let's aim much higher.
Right, not just doing damage control, as has been sort of the tact that the prior administration sometimes was taking. So in pushing for the federal government to use the Defense Production Act in the COVID crisis, as you've explained, have you encountered any misconceptions from people about what that could mean?
I don't think that even most members of Congress, and this is based on conversations with hundreds of offices over the last 8 months, I don't think most staffers and members even realize that Defense Production Act is used as frequently as it is. I mean, 300,000 times a year by the last administration for, you know, like widgets for aircraft carriers or missile systems. They had no idea. And so it's not this like sacred law that can't be used. It's used all the time. So if it's going to be used for defense, then why not use it just as much to save people from dying of a virus that's already killed 430,000 Americans and so many more around the world? So I think that so many members of Congress just don't even realize how common usage of this law is. And we've been trying to get them to update the law itself to allow states to use it in a limited way. And I just think that members of Congress don't really know how to lead when it comes to disasters. Like, they have sat on legislation for months, and they've not really passed much at all since the beginning of this COVID disaster. So we've been calling them to be more proactive, to open it up a little bit, let states make requests under Defense Production Act in a limited way around production and prioritization. I don't really understand why they haven't gone for that, but I think they really haven't gone for much. Like, Congress has not done much at all. Like, not much has passed really since the COVID disaster started. So maybe things will change now that the balance of power has shifted, and we're renewing our calls for a range of options, but all of them involve using Defense Production Act more aggressively.
If our listeners are interested in, you know, learning more about this or supporting your efforts, what's the best way for them to do that?
Yeah, they can join our email list at disasteraccountability.org. And not only are we working on this advocacy, but we're trying to shine the light on the frontline organizations that are really doing the hard work on the ground, helping communities respond to COVID, both in the U.S. and globally. And they can find that list of organizations at smartresponse.org.
Cool. And do you have any final thoughts before we wrap up? Anything we didn't cover?
I really appreciate the opportunity to talk about this. And I think that, you know, the stronger the questions are from members of the media, actually more we'll see from this administration. They've taken questions from, you know, the previous day, and then you'll see announcements the following day that indicate that they are listening. And so I'm hopeful that we will have more a favorable reception from this administration. At least they're taking this disaster more seriously, which is a good step.
Agreed. Well, Ben, thank you so much for speaking with me today. I really appreciate you taking the time.
Yeah, thanks so much.
I've been speaking with Ben Smilowitz, the executive director of the Disaster Accountability Project, about how the Biden administration can use the Defense Production Act to combat the COVID crisis. Find this story and all our coverage online at kbu.fm/eveningnews. For KBU News In Depth, I'm Althea Billings.
Hi, my name is Dr. Mark Allen Derry, and I'm an infectious diseases specialist in New Orleans.
Hi, my name is Doc Griggs, and I'm a community medicine doctor and health literacy expert. This is the Noise Filter Podcast, where an infectious diseases physician,
that's me, and a health literacy and communications expert,
that's me, talk about what you need to know about COVID-19.
You can find more information about this show and our other daily live updates and Q&A show at noisefiltershow.com.
So let's get started.
We're back today with the second part of our reporting about the new vaccines. So roll up your sleeves, sit back. We're going to be super excited. We are definitely going to be on point here.
Is that why, even though they're both mRNA, Pfizer and Moderna, vaccines live at different temperatures?
Yeah, that's exactly right. Now, Moderna has been working on mRNA vaccines for a while and even created the lipid molecular shell that is much more stable than what other companies use. Although there is a rumor of another vaccine in the works that may even be more stable than Moderna's. Yeah, and also, can I also say this? Moderna,
yeah.
Right? It's got the M. and it's got the RNA. Don't you have to roll? Doc Griggs has heard me say this a million times, but I just wanted.
Yeah, because ironically, they.
You just rolled your eyes at me.
Yeah, exactly. Moderna is a company put together specifically for this vaccine.
That's right. That's why they called it mRNA, Moderna. Yeah.
There should be those that, the more you know, with that ding and the light bulb playing when he says that, right? But let's get back to the mRNA. That you talked about this lipid layer, right? It's a layer of fat. Now, that helps protect the mRNA to keep it stable. Is that the way it works?
Yeah, this lipid layer is also made up of a substance which is similar to the outside of our cells. So this way it allows for the lipid particle to blend because it's made out of the same material. So it basically just blends right in to the cellular wall. And of course, that actually helps to absorb the mRNA so that they can begin its job of making those antigen or the spike proteins. Then it degrades so that it doesn't overwhelm our body.
Slowly.
Right. But Snapchatty.
Got it. So the nanoscience of this vaccine is pretty cool, but let's jump away from it for a few minutes. Talk about the different temperatures of vaccines and what that means for the distribution. And, you know, you're the expert here. So tell me first how cold these vaccines really need to be.
Well, the Pfizer vaccine needs to be kept really cold for a long period of time. It has to be around negative 70 degrees Celsius, which is about negative 94 degrees Fahrenheit.
Dude, I'm getting the chills just thinking about it.
Yeah. It has to be stored in special freezers found mainly in scientific labs.
So if it has to be kept that cold, how can it be sent around the country or around the world for that matter for distribution?
Now, Pfizer has created a detailed plan for how they can distribute the vaccine, even though it needs to be kept ultra cold. Now, they actually very early in the pandemic realized that they would have this problem and were very proactive about solving it. So they designed and mass produced a thermos that keeps the vaccine at minus 70 degrees using dry ice that can stay cold for up to 10 days. This is actually referred to as a cold chain, and this was very smart for them to do. So this way the vaccine could be transported from place to place.
What happens if it breaks or if it gets overheated during shipping?
Pfizer put temperature sensors in each package that transmit information back to them. This way, if any of the batches of the vaccine are not temperature controlled properly, they will know immediately and can remove that shipment. How cool is that?
Yeah, it seems like they thought of almost everything, huh?
Yeah. So once that shipment is received by the distribution center, such as in the hospital, they have three options. They can store it in the refrigerator where it'll hold for 5 days, or they can keep it in the shipping containers and keep replacing the dry ice for up to 30 days, or finally, they can place it in the ultra-cold freezer where it can be good for up to 6 months.
Dude, how big are these shipping containers?
They can hold between 1,000 to 5,000 doses of vaccine.
So if someone doesn't have an ultra-cold freezer or a lot of dry ice, they'll have 5 days to distribute up to 5,000 vaccines.
Yeah, so you just identified one of the biggest challenges. It's easy for large hospitals to use a shipment of vaccines before vaccinating staff and having it available for patients if there's extra. Now, these locations are also more likely to have access to ultra-cold freezers on proximity to research labs.
But it seems like places like drugstores or in the rural areas, they would struggle trying to distribute the vaccine in that way.
Exactly. So this has also created a scare in the past couple of weeks that there would be a shortage of dry ice. Earlier in the pandemic, like everything else, there was a period of time where dry ice production was down because the ethanol plants, where most carbon dioxide needed to make dry ice comes from, were closed.
Luckily, though, it sounds like a fear of dry ice shortage with vaccine rollout didn't come to pass. So how are we going to get the vaccine to rural places or countries without reliable electricity to keep freezers or refrigerators running?
Now, there's a lot going on in the world of innovation right now to address these problems. One company had the foresight to ramp up production of ultra-cold freezers all the way back in January. Scientists are even trying to create solar-powered freezers that can be used in places without reliable electricity.
Dude, this sounds amazing. And with us going deeper and deeper into it, I think now is a perfect time to bring on one of our amazing research residents, Karen. Dr. Karen, come on and fill us in. Help us out.
Hey guys, thank you for that introduction. I am Karen Schaefer, and I am one of the writers for Noise Filter. And as I said, I'm also a surgical resident. So with the time constraints of the Pfizer vaccine, it sounds like distribution centers would be in a huge time crunch to use all the vials of vaccine available.
They definitely are, Dr. Karen. And this is why hospitals and other places currently vaccinating are careful to make sure that people who sign up do come so that doses are not wasted. Those are very valuable.
It's also important to note, I think, that the temperatures needed to keep the vaccine usable might actually change as more data comes out about these different vaccines.
I love our writers. They're all brilliant. That's such a good point. Thank you for bringing that up. Now, Pfizer will keep testing their vaccine at warmer and warmer temperatures and adjust recommendations as it continues to get data. For now, they are being conservative as the vaccine is being rolled out.
So what about the Moderna vaccine?
Moderna is a little bit more stable. It can be stored in a regular freezer for up to 6 months and a regular temperature refrigerator for 30 days.
So we haven't talked about that other vaccine expected to receive FDA emergency use approval soon.
So that's true. This is the vaccine from Johnson & Johnson. So let's talk about what's different about this vaccine.
So the major difference is that it actually uses DNA and not RNA.
Right. And DNA is just like our genetic code, right?
Yeah, it's very similar. So basically what they're doing is they're using a modified version of a different virus called adenovirus, which is a virus of the common cold. And they're using that as a vector to deliver a DNA version of the COVID spike gene into our cells.
That's right. And just to be clear, that adenovirus they're injecting, they've kind of like chemically castrated it to a certain degree, right? It does not cause any of the typical common cold problems that humans have when they get adenovirus.
Exactly. It's just a vehicle to get the DNA into cells. They inactivated it so it can't replicate or manufacture any of its own proteins. But the reason they have to do this is that to work, the DNA actually does have to get into the nucleus or that center part of our cells where DNA lives, just so that it can be turned into mRNA.
I see. Okay. So then at that point, do our bodies then create the proteins as well?
Yeah. So basically, this is just taking it back one step. So we have DNA to RNA to proteins rather than just RNA to proteins.
Uh-huh. And does this vaccine need to be kept ultra cold as well?
No, so that's the nice thing about DNA. It's much more stable than RNA. So we're expecting it to be completely stable at the temperature of a regular refrigerator, which will make distribution much easier.
And what about it being as effective as the other two?
For now, we don't really have all of the data because the study hasn't been published yet. It's supposed to come out next month. We're all very excited to see what it shows, but they seem to be really excited about the results that they have so far. So I guess we'll have to wait and see, but at this time, it's looking promising.
Got it. And I have one more question. We're at the end of this segment, but here's my question to you. Can we have you full time and any chance you can replace Doc Griggs?
Please do. COVID-19 creating employment and mental health challenges for the LGBTQ community. Throughout the COVID-19 pandemic, many LGBTQ Americans have faced disproportionate employment and health struggles. Many in the community are facing poor mental health outcomes, homelessness, and lost income.
Now, Axios reports more LGBTQ Americans were living in poverty before the pandemic compared to all other Americans and are now reporting less access to jobs since the pandemic. On top of this, 35% of respondents in a study by the University of Chicago reported their ability to be hired was negatively impacted by rising incidents of discrimination this year. Even in San Francisco, homelessness amongst young people has become an issue as capacity in homeless shelters has decreased due to the pandemic.
Trans people of color are at the highest risk for homelessness due to less economic opportunities and LGBTQ-friendly employment. Particularly in the LGBTQ community, rates of depression and anxiety have increased the most in young adults. Before the pandemic, this subgroup already suffered increased rates of depression and anxiety. The number of youth reaching out for crisis support at times was double what their pre-COVID numbers might have been.
Yeah, discrimination may be a contributor to developing an underlying health condition among the LGBTQ community. They experience worse cardiovascular health compared to their cisgender and heterosexual counterparts. Cardiovascular disease and other heart conditions can increase the risk of developing worse COVID-19 symptoms. And 29% of LGBTQ Americans reported pushing off medical care this year because they simply could not afford it. Again, we've been talking over the last couple stories, Dr. Griggs, about vulnerable communities. And again, this is a community that we need to continually be watching out for, and we'll continue to follow as the story progresses. Just as a reminder, that COVID-19 and the human immunodeficiency virus do share the same risk factors. Doc Griggs?
Thanks for listening to the Noise Filter Daily Podcast. Dr. Darry and I have a daily show at 4 p.m. Central Standard Time where we go into more detail on stories and answer your questions about COVID-19.
You can find Doc Griggs at DocGriggs1 on social media, and you can find me at Dr. Mark Allen Darry or at DRDERY. You can follow us at NoiseFilter on Instagram, NoiseFilterNola on Twitter, and for more information about us and the show, you can go to NoiseFilterShow.com. Hey, Doc Griggs, any last words?
Remember, get checked, get fit, get moving. And remember to get some rest to boost your immune system. And Doc?
Protect yourself and others by staying home, and please wear masks when you go outside. Remember, health is a human right.
Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz, and this is KBOO Portland.
Is your organization planning a virtual event? Looking for a media co-sponsorship?